Okay, so we should start. So it is my pleasure to introduce Yannick Wurm. So he's originally from France, and he's now a PI at the Queen Mary University in London. He did his PhD with Laurent Keller, and that's when he started working on ants, and he did a postdoc and then went to London. Let's welcome him.
Thank you, and thanks for the organizers for organizing this. It's a wonderful symposium. Everyone knows what the things in front are, but what's in the back? Come on, yes, plastic, good. You get one third of a point, Laurent. Anyone else? You can kind of make out, where's my pointer? There's two channels here. There's one channel, there's another channel. This is a MySeq, Illumina MySeq chip. You guys have all used these. This is what it looks up closer. It's an old one, right? So that's why there's bubbles here that normally mess up your data. Anyhow, I know, you know, people are a bit tired. I'm going to do like 2 minutes of YouTube-y stuff, if that's okay with you, just to make sure everyone's back. Right, there's 15,000 species of ants. There's huge diversity in their morphologies between species. These are workers from different species of ants. And it turns out that there's just as much diversity in their lifestyles. You know this, but I'll tell you anyway. You know, in the rainforest in South America, you'll find some that cut leaves and bring them back to the nest, but leaves are hard to digest, so they eat the fungus that grows on the leaves instead. They farm it. It's a long-standing mutualism. These guys, they live up in the trees, and the larvae, rather than use silk to protect themselves for metamorphosis, the silk is used to stick together leaves as glue, and so they end up living in these aerial chambers that you know are wonderful protected places. This little Brazilian ant, they're a bit camouflaged. This is the entrance of the nest. Every evening, they're cool. Every evening, they close the entrance from the nest, from the inside, but also from the outside. So a handful of individuals stay outside, and this is half an hour accelerated. By the time they're done, you can see smooth sand, but it would be hard to pinpoint where exactly they were. And those guys head off in different directions. They die during the night. Of course, we interpret that they do this in anticipation of a potential predator. So, you know, rare example of preventative self-sacrifice outside of humans. And then you have these kinds of lifestyles, too, where hundreds of thousands of individuals are always on the move. And if they find the entrance of a social insect colony, they'll go inside and overpower any defenses and have a feast. We can go on and on and on. There's tons of really cool stuff going on in terms of the behaviors, the lifestyles, and then also the types of conflicts that can occur within the societies. We know a lot about the evolutionary context in which this kind of thing happens. We're only beginning over the past, you know, few years to understand what the genetic bases of some of these new lifestyles are. And as some of you know, we're going to talk about one species in particular that makes it through American immigration. These fire ants, they're native in South America, and they were brought with soil. People were bringing plants that brought soil, that brought ants to Alabama, and then since spread to many warm parts of the world. These guys, you know, they're called fire ants. They latch onto you with their mandibles, and then they inject venom with their stinger, like a wasp. And because there's usually not just one ant alone, if you get stung, then, you know, it can be quite unpleasant. Each bump burns for up to a few weeks, hence the name fire ant. And that makes them a really big pest. And also the mounds are big and they can damage farming machinery. Anyhow, Americans hate them. And this actually makes them the best studied ant. It's the one where you really know the most about all the different parts of its life. Here, what we're interested in is that this species has two social forms, two lifestyles within one species. And so we have the ancestral social form, one colony, one queen per colony, and a derived social form that has multiple queens in the colony. I'll skip the details of how we figured out that there's a supergene that determines this. The way it works is that in a single queen colony, everyone is big B, big B, and small b is always on its own, but small b is kind of necessary and sufficient to make the colony be a multiple queen colony. And this system is fixed. So Laurent and friends showed that you can't mess with this, basically. If you add another queen into a single queen colony, she'll be executed by the workers. If same thing happens to a big B queen that you try to put into a multiple queen colony, Or some of them are even born into multiple queen colonies, but they are executed by the workers. However, the heterozygous queens, they smell different. So the queens that carry the small bee variant of the supergene, they smell different, and based on that, the workers will accept them into the nest. It's a bit of a unique system here. You guys know that supergenes are found in all kinds of different places. And I thought today I'd focus on a handful of things that we've been looking at recently in the system. So when we were trying to understand why there's no recombination at a mechanistic level between big B and small b, we used this early long molecule sequencing technology. It doesn't give you ACGTs, but instead it gives you locations of restriction enzyme patterns, you know, where the restriction enzyme would normally degrade. And it gives you those patterns on relatively long molecules. Anyhow, that showed that there's, you know, several inversions that restrict recombination. But also one thing that stood out is that there's these extra bits of DNA where we find bits of DNA present in the small b individual, but no kind of, or far less extra bits of DNA in a big B individual. And we find this kind of systematically, and we also looked with a different approach where we estimated genome sizes of haploid big B males and haploid little b males from the same colony or from a neighboring colony. And we find that basically the small b males' genomes are bigger than the big b males' genomes. And so that implies that the small b supergene variant is almost double the size as the big b supergene variant. So what's going on here, and how do we equate that with what we know about older supergene systems, where, you know, we know that the one that never recombines, like the small b, it loses genetic material. Well, here, you know, people can call this degenerative expansion. Right after recombination stops or is suppressed, there's still really strong purifying selection on the supergene variant, on the functional genetic elements in there. And so you cannot yet lose big chunks of DNA. Instead, you can have accumulation of mildly deleterious stuff. And so that, in our, in here, it can mean things like accumulation of new transposable elements, expansion of existing repeats, and so this is kind of the pattern that we see here and that we're finding in the fire ant supergene system. Probably, in our system, this is exacerbated. This purifying selection is exacerbated by the fact that male ants are haploid. So from egg to adult, if you're male, you only have one copy of everything. So if that one copy is broken, well, then you won't be able to fertilize a queen. So that probably makes really strong purifying selection. Anyhow, as this stuff happens and more degeneration occurs of the supergene, well, the functional parts degenerate too, and then I guess the rest of the genome can begin to compensate, perhaps through dosage compensation, perhaps through genes jumping onto autosomes. And once that has happened, well, then the cost of losing the degraded functional elements are much lower, and you could see the type of big loss of DNA that we see in older supergene systems. I'll shift gears slightly. We wanted to understand what was going on in terms of the genes in the supergene region. Now, there's more than 400 genes. We did examine gene expression to understand, what are the differences between single and multiple queen colonies, and what kind of differences are there between the big B alleles of the genes and small B alleles of genes within the heterozygous queens that you find only in multiple queen colonies. Long story short, we find very many gene expression differences in every comparison. And it's really tempting, you know, to conclude that all of these differences are adaptive. But then, you know, we thought about the fact that small b is degenerating, and that changed our perspective a bit. So for most of the genes, what we see is that the small b allele, it's expressed more lowly than the big B allele. And that's consistent with what you would expect if those alleles on the small b variant of the supergene are degenerating. However, in most cases, this doesn't mean that the overall expression levels of those genes are lower. Instead, the organisms or the genome is compensating by having higher expression of the big B alleles where the small B allele is being lower expressed. And so we end up with similar levels of expression of the genes in the multiple queen colonies as in the single queen colonies. So here we're finding that there seems to be a gene-specific dosage compensation taking place. However, for some genes, we do see much higher expression of the small B allele. And that's perhaps the type of pattern that we would expect for genes that are driving the phenotypic differences between the social forms. So genes where something that's present in the small B is making the colony a multiple queen colony. And these differences do lead to differences between the social forms and gene expression. It's few genes, you know, a dozen or so. But it would be hard to say that these are all genes that are responsible for social antagonism. And one of the reasons is that their patterns are not fine-tuned. So in most systems where you see allele-specific expression levels, including in humans, they tend to be fine-tuned to particular tissues. Here instead, basically, if something is highly expressed in the brain, if that small B allele is highly expressed in the brain, it's also going to be highly expressed in the gut. And it's unlikely that that both of those things would be adaptive. This is probably a collateral effect or an artifact of the fact that supergene architecture, it cannot be that readily fine-tuned because you lack the recombination in the system. Overall take-home message here is that we need to be very careful when interpreting gene expression patterns from these kinds of supergene systems. The last thing I wanted to talk about is the origin of the system. The context is that, as Laurent mentioned yesterday, there are several species where we have this social polymorphism and where we can find the variants of the supergene. Eckhart was going to do this work, but then a hurdle came up, and then another hurdle. So Eckhart is German; he's perhaps even very German. And then the first hurdle was that there was going to be the World Cup in Brazil, and then the second hurdle was that he was going to get married and go on a honeymoon, and so that added delays. But then ultimately, everything worked out perfectly. It turns out his wife is Mexican, speaks fluent Spanish, and the World Cup was going to be in Brazil. And our fire ants—they're from Brazil and other parts of South America. And so Eckhart and his wife got married, went on their honeymoon, and drove tens of thousands of kilometers collecting ants all over Brazil, and then ultimately also in Argentina. We also went to Uruguay. And so we ended up with a really nice data set. So here, 360 haploid male genomes, each, most of them are from different colonies. Sometimes we have big B and small B haploid males from the same colony. This is about double the data set that Laurent mentioned yesterday. The haploid males are really pleasant to work with because, with relatively low coverage sequencing, you unambiguously know, what the genotype is at a current place. And you also unambiguously know if there's any kind of problem with the reference sequence for the location that you're looking at. Right, so the idea is simple. Build a species tree from chromosomes 1 to 15, and a cartoon version of this might be like that. And then separately, build a supergene tree from the non-recombining region or the region of reduced recombination. And there, you can imagine, perhaps the thing emerged in a common ancestor, or perhaps there's two parallel origins. Or perhaps there's introgression where it evolved in one system and then afterwards jumped species boundaries to get into another system. And the idea is really simple, but the implementation is actually much more involved than that because of the noise in the genome. Many here will be familiar with incomplete lineage sorting, right? The blood type that you have personally may be more similar to the blood type of that chimpanzee in the zoo than the person sitting next to you because those blood types are older than speciation. We know in this system that there's been tons of, in the Solanopsis complex, that there's been tons of hybridization and introgression in the past. So that creates noise. Any gene that's part of a multi-gene family, they have turnover, right? You don't know that one gene copy is orthologous to what you're looking at in another species. So that very easily creates noise if you're comparing across species. And then this one, right? The simple model is inversion recombination suppressed. But that's not the truth, because there's other things going on. And I don't know how much of the different, you know, non-homologous, et cetera, or double crossing over are going on. But what we see in the data is really clear. So if there was a bottleneck and all the genetic variation within this non-recombining small B chromosome was new, had arisen through novel mutations since small b came to be, then you would expect the genetic variation within small b to be completely independent from the genetic variation within big B. But that's not the case. We see a lot of places where the same loci have two alleles in small b and also have those same two alleles in big B. So there's something going on that we don't understand the mechanism. You know, this thing has survived all that, but we see shared alleles. And then furthermore, you know, this ant, it has the most highly repetitive genomes of all the ants, and there's all kinds of crazy things going on with transposable elements, and that can create noise, right? So if in this species, in this population, that transposable element, you know, jumped over from somewhere as active, it'll insert everywhere, you know, that can make things seem more similar within population, and if you're looking at that particular region, can mask more general patterns. How many people know this kind of IGV view? Yeah, okay, a third. So for those who don't, this is like the standard way that you want to be looking at data, right? So each of these gray things is one DNA sequence read. There's just a small chunk, 5,000 nucleotides of the reference genome. And you see that here, you know, this is the, and this dark gray bit at the top shows how many reads there are in that part of the genome. And whenever there's a nucleotide that's different in the sequence read from the reference genome, then you see a colored line up here. Here, I guess it's relatively straightforward. In most cases where there's a line in a difference between one read and the reference genome, all of the reads have that same difference. Here's an example where it's a bit different. So this part on the right here has that same kind of pattern. When there's one difference, everyone has it. But from this part, I've drawn a box around. You can see that when there's a difference, it's only supported by some of the reads, right? So there's a line, but there's no equivalent line there. Here we can also see that the overall number of reads mapping to this part of the genome, it's about double what it is for, you know, this part of the genome. And so probably what's happened here is that the stuff inside that blue box, there's two copies of that in that focal individual. If you're a genotyping algorithm that supposes that you're a haploid individual, this creates a mess, right? What allele are you going to say this individual has at that position, the blue one or the red one? You end up having genotypes that are a hybrid mess of transposable elements, some of which may be from this region, but we don't actually know. The second copy of this may be on an autosome or a completely different part of the genome. You get this kind of thing throughout the small b supergene in intergenic regions. So what we decided to do, you can try filtering those out, but any filtering attempt is always imperfect. We took the extreme other route, which is to focus on the most boring parts of the genome, the single copy housekeeping genes. So the genes where all of the insects always have one copy. And here, I mean, it's the same two individuals, a big B individual and a small B individual. And there, basically, in both situations, the picture is much cleaner, much easier to understand. Right. So we decided to eliminate all the noise. We also had a depth filter. And then another thing we did is, rather than try to concatenate all the genome and try to force a single tree onto the whole genome, which we know is something that's untrue, instead we build one tree for each gene. And then we use some software that's a bit smart about reconstructing what the story is for the genome on average to end up with this kind of a species tree for all our different samples. And you can see, this left part is chromosomes 1 to 15, very nicely separated important places, I guess. We did the same thing for the supergene region. So here we had about 1,600, 1,800 genes. The supergene region, we only have about 100 of these single copy genes that every insect needs to have exactly once to function. So that should be under really strong purifying selection. We do that on the supergene region. We find, okay, single origin of small b. All of the small b sequences group together. And then very strongly supported node where they branch off from S invicta. Over here you can see that some of these S. madonnahi samples, so this is in some cases called a different species, but it's actually, in our phylogeny, it groups together with S. invicta. So origin within here. But then if you look at where some of these small b samples are coming from, they're coming from a bunch of different places. And each of these numbers represents one different situation where we find that small b chromosome in a different species. So these are different introgression events that are highly supported. This really surprised us to see this many introgression events, because introgression of something across species should be hard, and especially if something that's really big should be hard, because the rest of the genome is normally co-evolving with the introgressed thing, co-evolving with the supergene, and you generally should have incompatibilities between species. And the fact that the chromosomes 1 to 15 are highly supported shows that, okay, there's not normally gene exchange between species. But here it's happened for the supergene. What this implies is that the benefits of the social form that's encoded by the small b variant of the supergene outweigh the kind of genetic cost of carrying that supergene. I suspect that the social and selfish nature of small b facilitated this, providing a type of social buffer. So apologies for the last minute crummy animation. But so imagine a Solanopsis invicta queen. She goes out, and instead of mating with a Solanopsis invicta male, she ends up mating with a Megrigates male. This is a different species that didn't have the supergene. She goes back to join an existing nest, lay some eggs, and then some of them will become young queens, and those are complete hybrids. And because they're complete hybrids between these two species, they should have low fitness. But there's a social buffer, right? They don't need to get food themselves. They don't need to rear the babies themselves. Just some of them need to survive to become new queens. This hybrid young queen, probably because of preferences or other things, ends up mating with a Megrigates male again. And you might end up having that several times with essentially end up backcrossing so that everything except the small b supergene ends up of X Megrigates background. And so after a while, you get what we see now, which is that the small b supergene, which came from the other species, exists, and this social form exists in this species as well. Anecdotally, we find, so we think this is the way it likely happened in the multiple cases where the introgression occurred. Anecdotally, we have additional support for this particular scenario with these two species, because we see a colony where the nuclear genome is clearly S. Megrigates, but where there's the small b supergene that's close to all the other small b supergenes, and also the mitochondrial haplotype of Invicta colonies that are from a neighboring population just a few kilometers away. So that would have been a kind of the most recent introgression. Others will have been much older. Okay, I think I'm hitting time here. So we have this funny system in the fire ants. We see a lot of patterns of degeneration of the small b variant of the supergene in terms of it getting bigger and accumulating all kinds of crap. And then we see that this also influences gene expression and creates patterns that are difficult to interpret. Furthermore, we find that here, the supergene architecture actually allows a really complex social phenotype to cross species boundaries. Thank you for your attention and to everyone who's contributed to this stuff.